This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, the host of The Takeout, joined as I am every week by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris, the political editor of CBS News. Hello, Steve.
Good morning, Major.
So, we are constantly pursuing new and interesting frontiers here on The Takeout podcast, and the frontier we are exploring today is an actual office on Capitol Hill. If you hear a kind of an echo around us and you don't hear the normal happy restaurant sounds you're accustomed to, and have grown accustomed to, it's because we are in Cannon House Office Building number 317, which happens to be the office of Congressman Will Hurd of Texas, 23rd District. Congressman, thanks for the hospitality. Thanks for letting us bring all of our gear and all of our questions to your office. Welcome to The Takeout.
Well, y'all got to give me more heads up so I can make sure I'm not chewing my food.
That's a part of what's going on here, folks, to let you
Thanks for coming.
So we don't have a restaurant, but we do have food. Outstanding morning breakfast tacos provided by Republic Kolache.
Actual takeout on
yes,
The Takeout.
Yes, actual takeout. And some of you on Twitter and in our email said, guys, it's not even a takeout. You never leave with food. Well, the food's been brought here. We have real takeout. And on Capitol Hill. So we move the show around. We do different things. We explore all sorts of possibilities to bring conversation about politics and policy to you however you find us on whatever means, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or if you watch us in our kind of semi-cool TV show on CBSN. Hello, the cameras over there. So, Congressman, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into politics, and I want to know exactly why you got into politics. Because it's an interesting part of your career before politics. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, first off, welcome, 317 Cannon. Thanks for bringing the breakfast tacos.
Our pleasure.
You know, I spent 9.5 years as an undercover officer in the CIA, and there was two things I dreamt about when I was overseas, breakfast tacos and Oreo cookie shakes. And so thanks for bringing one of those two. But I was born and raised in San Antonio. My folks still live in the house I was born into. My father is black. My mother is white. He was a salesman. She was a seamstress. Being a married interracial couple in the 70s in the South was not in vogue. But I'm you know, they're,
to put it mildly.
Exactly. But their love for one another was obvious, and it still is. My dad's 85. My mom's is 74. And I'm the baby of three. And I went to Texas A&M University. A good SEC school, I know. You know, we can talk Big 12 SEC a little bit later. And I was a computer science major. And my freshman year, I'm walking across campus, and I had never been outside of Texas. And I see a sign that says, take two journalism classes in Mexico City for $450. $425, excuse me. And I had $450 in my bank account. So I went to Mexico. Fell in love being in another culture. I thought it was really cool seeing things I had only read about in books, and decided to do international studies. And the first class I took in international studies, I had a guest lecturer who was a former CIA tough guy. You know, he was an old school Cold Warrior, ran operations in Russia, amazing stories. And I went to his office the next day and said, tell me more. And that began my interest in the CIA. And so when I graduated from Texas A&M, I went straight into the agency. I was what's called a case officer, so I was the dude in the back alleys at 4 o'clock in the morning collecting intelligence on threats to our homeland. I did 2 years in D.C. at what I used to call our super secret CIA training facility called The Farm. Now it's on Google Maps. I did 2 years.
As is just about everything in the world. Yeah,
exactly,
on Google Maps.
Exactly. 2 years in India, 2 years in Pakistan, 2 years in New York, and then about a year and a half in Afghanistan, where I managed our undercover operations.
How did you get those postings? Those are particularly challenging posts. India, maybe less so, but certainly Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Well, it was, you know, when, you know, because I came straight out of undergrad, I was in a program that takes a little bit longer time. You spend a little more time at headquarters. And I joined the CIA to go overseas, not to work in Washington. And the opportunity for India came because you know, you don't need another language to be effective. It's a difficult environment in which to operate, and I thought it would be a good tour. And then after that, you know, I knew I was probably going to go to a war zone, and I'd prefer Pakistan because same issues I was dealing with in India, but the exact opposite. And it was an amazing tour. Learned a lot about the world. You know, I've spent time in the Hindu Kush Mountains. I've been at the Khyber Pass. You know, I always tell, I speak in as many high schools as I can, and I tell the kids, I was like, you know, Genghis Khan has been in the Khyber Pass. Mm-hmm. Alexander the Great, yes, has been in the Khyber Pass, and so has Will Hurt, you know, which is, it's kind of cool to see that kind of connection and see things that folks that we've read about in our books have seen. So it was an amazing experience, but I also had to brief members of Congress. And that was one day I'm in Kabul, and a bomb goes off in front of the embassy, takes out a section of the wall, kills some local guards. My unit was responsible trying to help figure out what happened. And we conduct a couple of dozen operations in a short period of time, which was a lot for us. And we had a CODEL that night. A congressional delegation was in the embassy in Kabul to learn more about what was going on. This is a 2008-2009 time frame, by the way. And our standard operating procedure was, you know, for briefings, you're supposed to be business casual, right? You know, button-up shirt, slacks, sport coat. I'm in tactical gear. My hair is a mess. My hair was a lot longer when I was over there, and my beard was a lot bushier.
We'll get pictures of that, yeah, well, I guarantee.
Well,
you,
my campaign team always wants to know if I have pictures. It's like, I don't think folks in West Texas want to see me looking like a Taliban, you know? And I walk in the briefing, and the first one member says, is the CIA going to cut this briefing short so we can get to the bazaar to buy rugs? I'm annoyed, obviously. We get into the briefing, and a member who had been on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence for 4 years asked, why was Iran not supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan the way they were supporting other groups in Iraq? Now, your listeners are sophisticated, and they probably recognize how terrible of a question that is. But he asked a question, so I decided to answer. And I started explaining the Sunni-Shia divide. And the same member raises his hand and says, hey, Herd, what's the difference between a Sunni and a Shia? And I'm thinking he's getting ready to make a really inappropriate joke, and who am I to deny him this opportunity? And my response back was, I don't know, Congressman, what's the difference? And I'm getting ready to go, you know, ba-dum-bum-bum, right? His face goes bright red, didn't know that difference in Islam. And, you know, I always say it's okay for my brother not to know that because he sells cable. But for a person who is making decisions on sending our boys and girls to places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, it's unacceptable. For someone who's making decisions on spending billions of hard-earned taxpayer dollars, it's unacceptable.
And someone on the Intelligence Committee for 4 years.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I would agree with your point about any garden variety member of Congress, but especially someone who'd been on the Intelligence Committee for 5 minutes, let alone 4 years.
100%. And my mama always said, you're either part of the problem or part of the solution. And so I decided to move back to my hometown and run for Congress. And I lost the first time I ran, so I'm glad I don't tell that story anymore. But
in life, defeats teach a lot more than victories.
It really does. You know, I honestly didn't have a plan B. And during that first campaign in 2010, people would always ask, well, what's your plan B if you don't win? And I said, well, I don't have one. They're like, oh, that's what you're supposed to say. No, I actually didn't have a plan B. And I lost a runoff in a primary by 700 votes. And everybody expected me to win that primary. And what made it worse is in the weeks after the loss, I'd be in the grocery store and people would come up to me and say, hey, Herd, how's the campaign going? I'm like, I'm lost. And they're like, shucks, I forgot to vote, me and my wife. And I've really counted 735 people that said that. And I remembered those names, right, for just in case there was a next time. But, you know, I talked to 75 people, the all walks of life. I was 32 at the time. And people from different parts of the country. And I said, if you were 32 again, what would you do? And if time and money wasn't an issue, what would you do? And I got 74 crummy answers. I thought I was going to get, you know, a big reveal of like, what's the next big idea? But the 75th was this, the father of one of my best friends. My closest friends are these knuckleheads I've known since I was 13 years old. And my buddy's father says, I don't know what you should do, Harry, but do something meaningful and hard. And if you do something meaningful and hard, all these other things will flow. And so it was a great experience. Became a partner consulting firm, helped start a cybersecurity company. And those were experiences that have made me a better legislator now, because I understand what it's like to start a business from flat-footed. I understand the pressures that the private sector faces from cyber actors and how they have to deal with that. And so it was a great experience. And when the opportunity came to run again, I took it in 14.
Your political career has basically been a few votes between victory and defeat, right? I mean, if you look back at 14, you won by 2,400 votes. Last year, you won by 3,000 votes or so. It's a district
that's 3,900. I'll call that
3,900. 4,000. But it's close in a congressional district. This is a district that voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, and there were no shortage of ads. Let's play the clip of clip number three. I just want to give you an example. I'm sure you heard this over and over again during your campaign last year, but I want to give our audience an example of what you were up against last fall.
Trump's just so disgusting and degrading. It just seems like he's invaded our lives, and he's the Republican nominee for president. And Republican Congressman Will Hurd is part of that whole Republican Washington mess.
So that was 2016. You won.
I heard those a few times.
You won against ads like that in a district that voted for Hillary Clinton. So you went against sort of the tide in those ads. This is only going to get worse for you, I think, in the next year or two, right? Don't you think? I mean, it sounds like it may be another rematch, perhaps, against who you defeated. But also, this is going to be Democrats who are very, very enthusiastic and really, I think, going to start throwing the anti-Trump stuff at you again. How do you deal with that? As somebody who, I mean, do you get tired of the fight?
No, I enjoy the fight. That's part of it, right? You don't get to help people if you're not willing to knock heads and lock horns. And it's just a fact of life. And because of this district, the nature of this district, it's the only competitive district in Texas that's really 50-50. So we've learned that our constituents, I have an independent relationship with my constituents. And I think it's easy for folks that are focused on politics up here in Washington, D.C., to forget that all politics are local. And I represent a big district, 29 counties, two time zones, 820 miles of the border. It takes 10.5 hours to drive from a city called Cotulla, which is in the southeast corner of my district, to San Elizario, which is in the northwest corner. It takes 10.5 hours driving 80 miles an hour, which is actually the speed limit in most of the district. And I've been to every county twice. In the last election, in the 114th Congress, I had been to every county at least twice. I did 400 public events, 50 town halls, 13 teletown halls. I had 4 million interactions with constituents. So folks have seen me, and they know who I am. So the fact that Hillary Clinton won this district by 4, I outperformed Donald Trump by 12,000 votes. And yes, I won by 3,900 votes, but that's about 1,900 votes more than the last time. So the trend line is going in the right direction. So it's going to always be a difficult seat. But guess what? Be honest. Treat people well. Tell people what you're doing and why you're doing it.
But to Steve's point, what's the Trump factor in your district? Do you feel it? You sense as – so here in Washington, mm-hmm. we can sort of get the impression, well – swing districts are all feeling this Trump effect in a very strong way, and members are either getting nervous or they're feeling or hearing footsteps like for the next election. Is that what you're going through?
No. My race was the most expensive congressional race in Texas. $21 million was spent. That's a crazy sum of money. The if you want to call it the Trump effect, it was already there. And guess what? All the nasty things that were said against me are going to be set again, and I get that. And the reality is it falls on deaf ears because people know what I'm doing up here. And so for me, it's work hard, spend time in the district, make sure you're talking about the issues people on the ground talking about. The reason Congress, as a body, as an organization, has such low approval rating is because what's discussed up here in Washington, D.C. is different than what you discuss when you're back at home. And until we bridge that gap, we're going to have a problem. So in the last Congress, I, in the 114th Congress, I got more bills signed into law than any other member of Congress. Each one of those bills had something to do with something a constituent had brought up. And I have to remind people, I'm a Republican, the last president was a Democrat, and I was on their target list. And so being that effective was not an easy thing to do. But that is what the district has recognized when they get with Will Hurd.
That is the voice of Will Hurd, Congressman from the 23rd District of Texas. We are in his office, Canon 317. That's why you hear the echo effect around us. We are plowing through a delightful array of breakfast tacos. Your esteemed host has already plowed his way through five of them, I will let you know. This podcast, the Takeout Podcast, is brought to you, as you know, every single week, every Friday morning. New episodes appear on those Friday mornings, and of course, we invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and we hope at some point in the near future, you'll be able to find us on Spotify. We're working on that. Also, go to takeoutpodcast.com. You can follow us and like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. That's at takeoutpodcast, at takeoutpodcast. That's how you can find us. I'm Major Garrett. You are listening to The Takeout.
You're listening to The Takeout.
So, as you know, we have this novelty experiment going on here at The Takeout. I love it, as I've loved few things more in my life, because it is so rooted in my experience as a child of the 70s, if you will, not a child of the 60s, born in 1962. So in the 70s, if you wanted something from a company or you wanted to do something with a company to have them send it to you, you would send a self-addressed stamped envelope. That's how you got it. That's the only way you could get it. Well, we have these amazing little Takeout Podcast stickers. They're very good for your laptop. They're good for your bumper. They're good for any place you would like to apply a sticker. And I will sign and have signed these stickers. But the only way you can get them, we will not take any social media requests for this. We won't take an email request, at least not now, because we're trying this very old school experiment where you can only receive one if you send us a self-addressed stamped envelope. And Steve is here to tell us about exactly how much this has caught on across
our
great country.
Look at the stacks of mail that we've received. This is the third call we've had from
We don't have a mail bag yet, but we do have a mail Ziploc bag. So we're trying to graduate from the small
office envelope
Ziploc bag
filled with 35 pieces of mail from 20 states and the District of Columbia. One from
viewer mail.
Justin Cross, who works for the International Society of Arboriculture, which I had to listen to find out how to say that, but these are the guys who deal with trees. And he just wanted to let everybody know, including Major and the letter N, Steve, that he will be in D.C. for the first week of August for the International Tree Climbing Championships, which I had no idea was a thing. But apparently at the National Arboretum from July 28th to 30th, they're the International Tree Climbing Championships. It sounds very exciting. I hope we could maybe swing by. He says he would love to see us there and bring the kiddos. So hope we can make it.
Broadly defined at the Takeout, the kiddos. Lots of people qualify
for
that.
But keep the cards and letters coming, folks. We love it. And if you'd like your very own Takeout Podcast sticker signed by Major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News, at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
That's Steve Shigaris, political editor of CBS News and the world's greatest podcast sidekick. I am here to tell you that is the absolute truth. We are in Cannon House Office Building 317. We've never been in a member of Congress's office before. We take the Takeout Podcast wherever we can find the most interesting conversation in any given week, and that's brought us to your office, Congressman. Let's talk about what's before Congress right now. You just did a lengthy conversation with our listeners about the disconnect between Washington and any member of Congress's home district. So let's get down to brass tacks. There is now a revised and revamped Repeal and Replace Obamacare Act drafted by your colleagues in the House. Are you for it? Are you going to vote for it? And where is this heading?
It's too early for me to say, am I for it? Am I not for it? There is a lot of conversation around it. I have to dig into the text of this amendment that people are talking to and get feedback from folks in my district that are involved in healthcare. And the way I look at any issue is, Is it going an issue when it is related to healthcare? Is it going to increase access to or decrease cost of healthcare? And that is the that's kind of how I make my decision on this. And this is a difficult topic. This is a extremely political topic because of all the rhetoric over the last couple of years. But when it comes to people's lives, we got to be making the right decisions. And the conversations are good, and where they're going to go, I honestly don't have any insight in that, because as I've learned with this process, there's going to be amendments to the amendments. There's going to be additional side conversations, and it's really hard to make a decision until, hey, this is the actual thing that we're going to be voting on.
What are you hearing from people in your district? This is an issue that your fellow Republicans in the House, in some pretty safe Republican districts, have experienced very vocal constituents coming to town hall meetings and whatnot to complain about what's going on in terms of Obamacare here. What are you hearing from your constituents? What kind of events are you doing in your district to
hear? Are they fearful about losing coverage, for example?
Yeah, look, people are fearful about losing coverage, but they also accept the fact that Obamacare is not working as well. And Texas experienced a 33% increase in premiums when it comes to folks on the individual market, and that there's projections that that a similar increase is going to happen very soon. And so people recognize that the current process is flawed, and they want to make sure that whatever is replaced is something that is going to be better. Right. And so that's, you know, we should be solving a real problem, not trying to achieve some political gain. And that's where I fall down on this issue. And that's what people in the district are asking. But people in my district are also asking about the border wall. They're asking about NAFTA and trade. They're asking about border adjustability within tax reform. These are some of their I have a very rural district. People are worried about the farm bill. The last 4 years, prices for every commodity is the lowest it's ever been. And we've never seen a confluence of those issues. And so these are some of the things that as I crisscross, I drove from San Antonio, El Paso and back over the last 2 weeks and did stops all along the way. And these were the things that I was hearing.
So
about.
Let's talk about the border wall.
Mm-hmm.
President wants money for it, didn't get it, won't get it in the remaining funding allocations for the fiscal 2017 budget. White House is going to fight for it in 2018. I asked him in the Roosevelt Room earlier this week if the wall would be built.
In your first term.
The wall is very, very important.
In your first term.
Well, it's certainly going to, sure.
He said yes, absolutely. You are not a fan of this idea.
No, I've been pretty clear. Building a wall from sea to shining sea is the most expensive and least effective way to do border security. I have 820 miles of the border, and there's only 2,000 miles of border between the U.S. and Mexico. I've spent 9.5 years as an undercover officer chasing Al-Qaeda and nuclear weapons proliferators and folks like that. You can't have a one-size-fits-all solution to border security. In certain places, the Border Patrol rates places as rural, urban, or remote. And in some of these remote places, it takes the response time is measured in hours to days. If your response time is measured in hours to days, a wall is not a physical barrier. So I was recently in El Paso sector. So the border is broken up into sectors. El Paso sector has 300 miles of the border. Only 60 miles has persistent technology on it that is looking at the border, cameras, things like that. That's a problem. And I think most Americans believe that we would be using the latest technology already along the border, but we're not. And that's why this funding bill that's going to be before us has more money to increase the purchase of technology so that we can have some situational awareness on the border. It's going to go to more people in Border Patrol. In my district, I need more horses in certain places because not more wall.
So let's listen to the president earlier this week on this very topic. That's soundbite number one.
The wall's going to get built, folks. Just in case anybody has any question, The wall's going to get built, and the wall is going to stop drugs, and it's going to stop a lot of people from coming in that shouldn't be here, and it's going to have a huge effect on human trafficking, which is a tremendous problem in this world. The wall is going to get built.
Have you spoken to the president about this issue?
I haven't spoken personally about this. And the one point that I would suggest we focus more on, the metrics. What metrics are we going to look at to say that we're successful? The metric that we should not be measuring how many miles of wall we have. That is not a metric that's going to tell us whether or not we improve security. The metrics are, do we see a decrease in the amount of illegal crossings? Do we see a decrease in the amount of drugs that are coming into this country? Those are some of the ways we do this. And it's an expensive way. So Coast Guard is only able to action 25% of the intelligence that they get on known narco-trafficante movement into the country. That's crazy. And the reason they can't do that is because they don't have enough cutters. They don't have enough people. So we already know that we have intelligence on things that we can stop, but we can't because we don't have the money to do that. That's a better use.
These are reasoned arguments, yet this is a political issue for the president, right? This is a promise that he made repeatedly on the campaign trail and continues to make. I guess the question is how do you... You're trying to make an argument about policy while he's basically saying, no, this is something I promised that I'm going to do. And there are a lot of people who either voted for him because of that or support that idea. So how do you sort of counter that, especially being a member of the president's party?
In the last 3 months, illegal crossings has decreased 40%. That's a big deal. That's a victory. There's a number of factors. One, Border Patrol is arresting kingpin human smugglers, which has driven the price of coming into this country illegally. It's almost doubled the cost of what you would pay a coyote to come across the border.
And a coyote is
a coyote is a smuggler. And so you know, it was expensive already. Now it's even more expensive. The fact that people are realizing that this administration is going to enforce our laws is preventing folks from coming here. And with also the expectation that it's going to be even more difficult to traverse the border. So those are the things, you know, that is a very real, in 4 years when the president is running again, and if he keeps those numbers up, those are great things to be able to campaign on rather than I built some structure over X number of miles.
That's the voice of Will Hurd, Congressman from the 23rd District of Texas. We are in his office, Cannon House Office Building 317, for episode 15 of The Takeout. You are listening to the aforementioned Takeout.
You're listening to The Takeout.
Welcome to our humble audio odyssey, episode 15 of The Takeout, being brought to you this week from Cannon House Office Building 317, where Congressman Will Hurd resides and his helpful staff. We are here broadcasting episode 15, and I want to tell you about something that we've got coming to you next week. So, as you may be aware, the White House Correspondents' Dinner is on Saturday. President will not be there. President Trump will be in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, doing a counter-programming rally. Fine. All well and good. There'll be White House reporters covering that. I will be at the dinner itself, as will Steve Shigaris, the world's greatest takeout podcast sidekick, or podcast sidekick of any kind. And we're going to do an open mic thing at our CBS Atlantic Magazine pre-party. So we're going to punch out a lot of content next week. We hope one every day, short interviews of ambassadors, members of Congress. There might even be a celebrity or two. We don't know. Steve, who's going to come to our stand-up table at our pre-party? But we're going to interview them, we're going to put it together, and we're going to give you content like you have never had before.
A
courtesy
deluge
of the Takeout
of content.
Podcast. Yes, a deluge. Indeed. Congressman Hurd, before we went to break, you talked about a couple of issues I want to bring to our listeners' attention through your perspective. NAFTA and tax reform. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, put together during the Clinton administration with the energetic assistance of the Republican Congress, big backers of it back then. The president, in the last couple of days this week, has suggested he might unilaterally withdraw from NAFTA.
Now it's subject to renegotiation with Canada and Mexico. When your constituents hear that, how do they react? And what are you going to do?
Well, they're nervous. Texas, Mexico is Texas's number one trading partner. And our economies are interlinked. The economies between Mexico, U.S., and Canada are interlinked. I was glad that last night the president got on the phone with President Peña Nieto of Mexico and Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada and say, listen, the goal is to improve the agreement, not a unilateral exit. So I think that calmed some people.
Yeah, the markets got very antsy when this rumor floated out at the White House about an executive order to unilaterally end the deal.
Right, and but I do believe that we should be talking about a NAFTA 2.0. How do we improve upon it? This was an agreement that was signed 24 years ago. In an area like energy, you know, we weren't talking about the Eagle Ford Shale 24 years ago. You didn't have the ability to have foreign direct investment in the energy sector in Mexico. Things have changed. With the U.S., Mexico, and Canada working together, we can improve North American competitiveness in other parts of the world. The reality is that the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, we build things together. 40% of the inputs that go into Mexican products come from the United States. That number is 25% in Canada. And to give a frame of reference, if you do that for China, it's only 4%. There is this notion that...
And for our listeners, when you talk about inputs, what does that mean?
So stuff that goes into products that, you know, would be considered made in Mexico, 40% of those inputs, 40% of the pieces or the parts that go into that product come from the United States.
And 25% for Canada.
And 25% for
and
Canada.
And 4% from China.
4% for China.
Got it.
And so there's a notion, yes, jobs are created by exports, but they're created by imports as well. Everybody knows Sara Lee, but most people don't know it's owned by a Mexican company called Bimbo. If you live in Detroit, there's a company called Rossini that employs thousands of people in Detroit. It's a Mexican company. Toyota in my hometown employs a lot of folks, and they get products in from Mexico. So jobs are created from inputs as well. And this is something that we need to educate folks. There's about 26 states where Mexico is the number one or number two trading partner. Almost more than half of the states in the U.S., Mexico is the number one partner, and Canada is either one or two, you know, on that as well. So this is something that's important. It's something that has actually been good for all three of our economies, and there are some areas where we can improve it. And President Peña Nieto and Prime Minister Trudeau have agreed with that.
So what do you say to the president when he says that first of all, these underlying agreements are they're not favorable to the United States, first of all, and then secondly, when he says that we're being outsmarted by Mexico and Canada when we sign these deals.
Canada's been very rough on us.
Their politicians are smarter than our politicians. What's your reaction to that? I mean, you seem to be pretty defensive of NAFTA and talking about its benefits, but the president is pretty adamant that this is not good at all for the United States.
Well, if you look at the growth of our economy and how that's been based on trade, the numbers are very clear.
So is he wrong?
I think he is focused on a few pieces and not looking at the total puzzle. And when you look, if you just look at the trade imbalance issue, a lot of times it says $60 billion with Mexico. Services aren't included in that. If a product goes back and forth across our border four times, that's hard to account for that. The number of folks from the number of Mexican citizens that are driving up to San Antonio, Texas, and shopping in our malls and eating in our restaurants, that's not factored in as well. And so I think understanding the complete picture is important. And I will say there was a draft letter to Ways and Means Committee a couple of weeks ago from the Department of Commerce. And I'm always reticent to comment on drafts.
Right.
Because you never know, you know, was it really a draft? Mm. Where is this going? But it indicated, you know, if that sentiment is truly what if that draft letter encompassed the sentiment of the Commerce Department, then I think we're going to be okay.
The sentiment was that
trade is good, and we can improve NAFTA on areas, even agriculture.
It was a softer sell on this whole point than the president gives. So let's shift to tax reform. Mm-hmm. Earlier this week, the White House gave the Congress and the country one page summary, a lot of spaces, not many details on the overall objectives of tax reform. The one page didn't even have income brackets for the three tax brackets the president says he's in favor of. I've never seen a supposedly serious tax reform proposal come with so few details. How do you react to it? What do you think tax reform or tax cuts, as many are calling it, not much reform, just a lot of cutting, is going to be? What's the politics policy on that?
Well, one page is a statement of principles. It's not a policy, and I think simplification of our tax code is a good thing. We have the House has been working on a plan. We call it a Better Way plan, and the goal is to have every American be able to do their taxes on a postcard. And if you're able to achieve that, then that means you don't need a very large IRS. They become more like a help desk than an enforcement agency. We want to make sure that middle class is able to keep more of their money in their own pockets and use that to invest however they want to invest it or spend it however they want to spend it. And I think that the debate on corporate tax rate is going to be something that evolves over the next couple of weeks. And how low can we get? We shouldn't have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. We should be able to get, whether it's $7 trillion or $11 trillion that's sitting overseas that could come back in the United States, having that and the impact that's going to have on our economy is important.
But to that point, when the Treasury Secretary and the National Economic Advisor to the President talked about this, they said we want to bring back the trillions of dollars in revenue that's offshore, but they wouldn't even say what rate on a one-time basis that revenue would be taxed at, lower than the 35% current rate. So when the White House, with a straight face, says we're in favor of tax reform and we have all these big, bold ideas, and yet even the most elemental specifics are missing, what does that tell you? Are you insulted by that? Should Congress be insulted by that?
Well, we shouldn't be insulted because we're the ones that write the law. All right, and so the law is going to get written by Congress, not the White House, and so those details and the nuance should come from the legislative body, not the executive branch. And so having a statement of principles is good. It's just like we always talk about the president's budget. The president's budget is a statement of ideals. The president does not get to fund the executive branch. It's the legislative branch's role to do that. And so the details are to be left up to the legislative branch, and that's what we've been working on, and that's what we hope we have an agreement. And there is bipartisan support on a number of areas when it comes to how we can supercharge our economy and make sure it keeps humming.
I think it's fair to say this president has created a good deal of expectation about his presidency, about what he would bring to Washington, how he would change the way this city works, and the outputs, if you will, on behalf of the constituents who voted for him. There is now a very real possibility that by the August recess, the president will not have tax reform. He may not have a repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. It may get through the House, but its future in the Senate is extremely up in the air, in limbo for sure. At what point is it fair to ask, what has this administration and what will it accomplish outside of executive action, which as a candidate Trump frequently criticized as an overuse of presidential power?
But it has been 3 months, right? I would say all those things you listed off, trying to accomplish those in 3 months is impossible. And that's why a president is allowed 4 years of a term. And in 4 years, when he goes back in front of the electorate, that's when he's going to have to prove what he has done. And having an arbitrary 100-day mark on you have to get X, Y, and Z done by that I don't, you know, I don't subscribe to that. You have your 4 years to achieve the things that you think you can achieve in order to make this country, to improve this country. And so that's the timeline of what we should be looking at. And this over-reliance on, you know, a 100-day mark, it's difficult because, look, he doesn't have everybody in office, right, in his positions. I don't think there's been a deputy approved. I think we had the first deputy approved this week. Of the 575-ish folks that need Senate approval, there's been, like, there's less than 100. And so this is part of the problem that you're seeing in the Senate and dragging its feet and getting the people that he needs in these positions to get the job done. So there is that piece as well. But, you know, this is up for y'all to decide whether why 100 days is important. But the American people are going to be able to grade his paper in 4 years.
Very good. That's the voice of Will Hurd, congressman from the 23rd District of Texas. We were here in his office, 317 Cannon House office building. First time we've brought the takeout into a member of Congress's office. It may not be the last. It may be, Steve, the one and only time this ever happens. We'll have to find
out. I hope
not. Exactly. That's the voice of Steve Chigueras, political editor of CBS and the world's greatest podcast sidekick. I'm Major Garrett, and you have been listening, and we thank you for it, to The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
Governor LePage of Maine, who, by the way, has lost a lot of weight. I knew him when he was heavy, and now I know him when he's thin, and I like him both ways, okay? Done a great job.